There was a constant movement of men and wagons across the rear. Porter's troops were over the river, slogging south in the wake of Keyes's, who had pulled out on the left. The men of Franklin and Sumner and Heintzelman, left behind, looked at one another and passed the word along. "It's a big skedaddle." Sunday they themselves had backtracked, fighting a series of rearguard skirmishes as they moved eastward down the railroad. Then at Savage Station they called a halt and rocked the pursuers back on their heels, land, Merrimack, and all. It was a victory, and they felt considerably better, especially Sumner, whose battle blood was up. The old man could scarcely believe his ears when he got orders to continue the retrograde movement. "I never leave a victorious field," he sputtered. "Why, if I had 20,000 more men, I would crush this rebellion." When someone finally found a candle, struck a light, and showed him the written order, he still protested. "General McClellan did not know the circumstances when he wrote that note. He did not know that we would fight a battle and gain a victory." Finally, though, he acquiesced. Orders were orders. Heintzelman had already left, and Franklin and Sumner followed, crossing White Oak Swamp in the darkness. By 10 o'clock next morning, the last man was safely across, and the bridge had been burned to discourage pursuit. It had not been accomplished without losses. A hospital camp of 2,500 sick and wounded was abandoned at Savage Station, together with an ample supply of medicines and surgeons who volunteered to stay behind with their charges. At the Chickahominy Railroad crossing, loaded ammunition trains were set afire and run full tilt off the wrecked bridge, with spectacular results. Sunday's landscape was smudged with the acrid smoke of burning cloth and leather, relieved from time to time by the more pleasant aroma of coffee and bacon given to the flames instead of to the rebels. The price, in fact, had been heavy, but so was the gain. Whatever else might be in store, McClellan's army was not going to be caught astride the only natural obstacle that lay athwart its line of march to the James. Monday was Lee's last best chance for the canny he had been seeking all along, and as usual he was early on the scene. The main blow, as he designed it, would be delivered by Longstreet and A.P. Hill just south of Glendale. If successful, this would sever the Union column, interrupt its retreat, and expose its disjointed segments to destruction in detail. But much depended also on the commanders of the various other columns of attack. On Huger, who would open the action on the left, on Jackson, who would force a crossing of White Oak Swamp and press the Federal rear, on Magruder, who would come up in support of the center, and on Holmes, who would advance on the right so as to bring the disorganized bluecoat survivors under his guns as they fled past him, reeling from the effect of the multiple blows. Since Magruder had the longest march, Lee rode over to Savage Station before sunrise to make certain he understood the orders and started promptly. The first commander he encountered there was not Prince John, however, but Jackson, who had finally repaired Grapevine Bridge and started his men across it before dawn. Both generals dismounted and advanced for a handshake, Lee removing his gauntlet as he came forward. According to a young artillery officer who observed the meeting, Stonewall appeared worn down to the lowest point of flesh consistent with active service. His hair, skin, eyes, and clothes were all one neutral dust tint, and his badges of rank so dulled and tarnished as to be scarcely perceptible. Yesterday's strange lethargy had left him, along with his accustomed reticence. He began talking in a jerky, impetuous way, meanwhile drawing a diagram on the ground with the toe of his right boot. He traced two sides of a triangle with promptness and decision, then, starting at the end of the second line, began to draw a third projected toward the first. This third line he traced slowly and with hesitation, alternately looking up at Lee's face and down at the diagram, meanwhile talking earnestly. Suddenly, as the third line intersected the first, he stamped his foot, apparently indicating the point at which McClellan would be wrecked beyond repair. "We've got him," he said decisively, and signaled for his horse. Lee watched him go, that strange man in another of his strange guises, then mounted to and continued his search for Magruder. Presently he found him. After making certain that Prince John understood today's orders as well as Stonewall did, Lee hurried down the Derby Town Road to establish army headquarters in rear of the proposed center of the impending battle. As events turned out, however, there was no need for haste. At any rate, not on his part. Longstreet's men were going forward, supported by Hill's, but it was noon by the time they formed their line near the junction with the Longbridge Road, facing eastward to await the already overdue boom of Huger's guns, signaling contact on the left. What came instead was a message. The South Carolinians' progress was obstructed, whatever that meant. Lee was left wondering. Southward, Holmes was silent too, nor was there any indication that Jackson was pressing down from the north against the enemy rear. Somewhere out beyond the screening pines and oaks, east of where Lee stood waiting for his lost columns to converge, the Federals were hurrying southward past the point where he had intended to stage his canny. He might still stage it. 7 hours of daylight still remained. If he could find the answer to certain questions. What had delayed Huger? What had happened to Holmes? And again, as so often before, where was Jackson? Huger had the shortest march of all, and what was more, he had made an early start. But he went slowly, fearing ambush, for which the terrain was particularly suited. This had been tobacco country in the old days, checkerboard neat for the most part, but in time the soil had leached out. Neglected, it had gone back to second-growth scrub timber, broken here and there by clearings where men still tried to scratch a living from it. The general's natural caution was further increased by the presence of White Oak Swamp, which afforded a covered approach to his left flank. Presently, to make matters worse, word came back that the road ahead was obstructed, the Yankees having chopped down trees that fell across it as they retreated. Instead of leaving his artillery behind or trying to clear the fallen timber from his path, Huger ordered a new road cut through the woods, parallel to the old one. Progress was slowed to even more of a snail's pace than before. And while he chopped, Longstreet and Hill, having formed for battle, waited. At 2:30, detecting signs of the enemy ahead, Huger brought up a couple of light field pieces and shelled the brush. Holmes, too, was involved in a nightmare this day, a far bloodier and noisier one than Huger's contest of axes, though in point of fact the noise was not a very disturbing element for the 57-year-old North Carolinian, who was deaf. After waiting most of the afternoon at the junction of the Newmarket and Longbridge roads, he received word that the bluecoats were streaming in thousands across Malvern Hill, a tall ridge 3 miles ahead, in the final stage of deliverance from the unsprung trap Lee had contrived for their destruction around Glendale. His 6,000 men were too few for a successful infantry attack on the heavy column of Federals, but Holmes decided to do what he could with his artillery to frustrate their escape. Accordingly, he rode forward, found a position well within range of the hill, then brought up 6 rifled pieces, supported by a regiment of infantry, and prepared to open fire. While the guns were being laid, he stepped into a house by the side of the road. Just then a single large-caliber projectile broke with a clap like sudden blue-sky thunder over the heads of his startled men, followed promptly by what one of them called a perfect shower of shells of tremendous proportion and hideous sound. The result was instantaneous pandemonium. Infantry and artillery alike, the green troops clustered and scattered and milled aimlessly about in search of cover, which was scarce. Some in their greenness took shelter from the 10-inch shells by crouching behind 2-inch saplings. Others simply knelt in their tracks and clasped their hands, palms down, on the tops of their heads. Placid in the midst of all this uproar, bursting projectiles, screaming men and horses, hoarse and futile shouts of command by rattled captains, Holmes emerged from the roadside house, suspiciously cupping one ear. "I thought I heard firing," he said. The big shells, called lamp posts, came from gunboats on James River, which looped northward within half a mile of the Confederate position. Soon Malvern Hill was wreathed in smoke as siege guns on its crest added canister to the weight of metal already falling on Holmes's demoralized soldiers. He pulled them back out of range. It was nearly sunset, and like Eugene, whose day-long two-mile march left him a full mile short of contact with the Federal main body hastening south across his front, Holmes had taken no appreciable part in the day's fighting. Nor had Magruder, who came up in rear of Longstreet just as the uproar exploded on the far right near the James, and was sent in that direction to help stem what sounded like a full-scale counterattack up the river road. Nor had Jackson, with better than one-third of the whole army under his command. After the early morning Savage Station conference with Lee, Stonewall had pushed on down toward White Oak Swamp, gleaning in the woods and fields a bumper harvest of abandoned U.S. equipment and prisoners as he went. This was always a pleasant task for the wagon hunter, and today it gave him particular satisfaction, affording as it did an outlet for his apparent superabundance of nervous energy. When a companion protested that the captives would be of considerable expense to the government, Jackson shook his head. "It is cheaper to feed them than to fight them," he said. He pressed on, encountering no opposition. There was time, even, to stop and write the usual Monday letter to his wife. "An ever-kind providence has greatly blessed our efforts," it began. About noon, approaching the sodden jungle of the swamp, he found that the Federals had already crossed it, burning the bridge behind them, and had emplaced their artillery on a commanding south side ridge, supported by heavy columns of infantry. Promptly he brought up his own guns under cover, opened suddenly on the enemy batteries, and saw them displace in frantic haste, abandoning three pieces in their confusion. Delighted, Jackson ordered his cavalry to ford the stream at once, intending for them to harry the fleeing bluecoats, and, in accordance with Lee's instructions, put a crew to work without delay, rebuilding the bridge in order to take up the pursuit with his infantry. So far it had gone well. Stonewall seemed to have recovered his identity. But now, quite abruptly, it stopped cold. The cavalry, having crossed, was repulsed by the Federal batteries, which had not fled, as had been thought, but had simply moved to a new position where they outgunned their smooth-bore rivals north of the swamp. Worse still, the ring of the sharpshooter's rifle, accompanied from time to time by the sickening thwack of a bullet striking flesh, drove the bridge builders from their work almost as soon as they got started. Worst of all, however, was Jackson's reaction, which was rather as if the mainspring of some tightly wound-up mechanism had suddenly lost its resilience or run down. Formerly alert and energetic, he grew taciturn and drowsy, even sullen. Recalling his troops from exposure to danger, he lay down under a tree and went to sleep. That was about 3 o'clock. When he woke an hour later, or half-woke, rather, sitting slump-shouldered on a log, the bill of his dingy cadet cap pulled down over his sleep-puffed eyes, he heard sounds of heavy firing from the south. It made little impression on him, though, nor did the suggestions of his lieutenants, who had been reconnoitering for a way around the impasse while he slept. A cavalry colonel sent word that he had located a usable ford nearby, but Jackson ignored the message. Wade Hampton, commanding an infantry brigade, went off on his own and presently returned to report in person that he had found an excellent downstream crossing that would bring his men in position to strike the unsuspecting Federal flank. Jackson stirred. Could Hampton build a bridge there? "Yes," the South Carolinian said, "but the noise might alert the enemy." "Build the bridge," Jackson told him. Hampton left. Soon he was back, reporting that the work had been done without alarming the Union troops. Stonewall gave no sign that he had heard him. For a long time he sat there on the log, silent, collapsed like a jointed doll whose spinal string had snapped. Then abruptly he rose, still without replying, and walked away. Hampton's bridge went unused, as did Jackson's third of Lee's army, which remained north of White Oak Swamp, out of touch with the enemy all day. At supper, soon after dark, Stonewall went to sleep with a piece of unchewed biscuit between his teeth. Jarred awake by his own nodding, he looked blankly about, then got up from the table. "Now, gentlemen," he told his staff, "let us at once to bed, and see if tomorrow we cannot do something." Of all the days in the eventful month since that last night in May when the President tendered him command of the leaderless army as they rode back from the confused and gloomy field of Seven Pines, this final day of June had been for Lee the longest and the saddest. None had promised more at the outset, or yielded less in the end, than this in which better than two-thirds of his soldiers were withheld from contact with the fleeing enemy by the inabilities and eccentricities of the commanders of three out of his four intended columns of attack. Davis was with him now as then, at 2:30, mistaking the boom of Huger's guns, shelling the brush on the Charles City Road, for the prearranged signal that the battle had opened on the left. Lee hurried north on the Long Bridge Road in search of Longstreet, and found him talking with the President in a little clearing of stunted pines and broom straw. As Lee rode up, Davis greeted him with a question designed to forestall a repetition of the repulse he had suffered at the Virginians' hands 4 days ago at Mechanicsville. "Why, General, what are you doing here? You are in too dangerous a position for the commander of the army." "I'm trying to find out something about the movements and plans of those people," Lee replied. For him, the Federals were invariably those people. Then, attempting to recover the initiative, he added, "But you must excuse me, Mr. President, for asking what you are doing here, and for suggesting that this is no place for the commander-in-chief of all our armies." "Oh," Davis told him with a smile, airy but determined, "I am here on the same mission that you are." Lee had to let it go at that, though presently the danger was considerably heightened. When Longstreet rode away and had some nearby batteries open fire in acknowledgment of what he thought was Huger's signal, the reply came not from the Confederates to the north, but from the Federals to the east. Suddenly the clearing was dotted with bursting shells. Concerned with the peril to Davis and Lee, A.P. Hill came dashing up and addressed them sternly. "This is no place for either of you, and as commander of this part of the field, I order you both to the rear." The two moved off. "We will obey your orders," Davis said. But when they drew rein, still within the zone of fire, red-bearded little Powell overtook them and spoke with the same mock harshness as before. "Did I not tell you to go away from here, and did you not promise to obey my orders? Why, one shot from that battery over yonder may presently deprive the Confederacy of its president and the Army of Northern Virginia of its commander." Abashed, the two withdrew beyond range of the exploding shells and the explosive Hill. It was then that Lee received unwelcome news that McClellan was closer to safety than he had supposed. A cavalry commander, patrolling ahead of Holmes on the river road, informed him by courier that the enemy, undamaged and unhindered, was crossing Malvern Hill within gunshot of the James. Lee at once rode down and saw for himself the truth of the report. The bulk of the Union supply train, accompanied by heavy columns of infantry, was making its escape. If the Confederate attack was delayed much longer, it would strike not the enemy flank, but the enemy rear, which meant that the chance for a canny would be gone. In fact, it might be gone already. Having approved Holmes's intention to disrupt the retreat as much as possible with his guns, Lee turned back toward Glendale. He still had heard nothing from Jackson and nothing from Huger except that his route was obstructed. But time was running out. Concentrated or not, he would throw what he had at the Federal flank before the tail of the blue column cleared the junction near which Hill and Longstreet had been waiting all this time. Encountering Davis, who reproached him again for rashly exposing himself, Lee replied quite truly, it was, in fact, the crux of the problem, what with the inadequate communications and the lack of an adequate staff, that all he could learn of the situation was what he saw with his own eyes. As he rode northward, the uproar of the naval bombardment exploded behind him. What it meant he did not know, but when he returned to the broomstraw clearing, still under fire from the batteries ahead, he found that Magruder, arriving at last, had been ordered south by Longstreet, who interpreted the heavy-caliber uproar as a counterattack by the Federals near the James. For all Lee knew, that was what it was. Besides, there was no time for recalling Magruder. If the assault was to be delivered before the Bluecoats cleared the junction, it would have to be launched at once by the troops at hand. That is, by the divisions of Longstreet and A.P. Hill. He told them to go forward, which they did. The result was the Battle of Glendale, or Fraser's Farm, it was sometimes called, since much of the hottest fighting occurred on this 200-acre property south of the junction. Not that it wasn't hot enough all over. In sending two divisions against an enemy force of undetermined strength, Lee's hope was that they would find the Federals strung out on the roads and unprepared. As it turned out, however, he was hoping for a good deal more of an advantage than his opponent was willing to grant. McClellan had disposed his 11 divisions with several eventualities in mind, and in fact was readier for this than for any other. Keyes's two divisions, along with two of Porter's, were already in position on Malvern Hill. Two more, one from Sumner and one from Franklin, were on rearguard duty, observing the quiescent Jackson across White Oak Swamp. Franklin's other division was astride the Charles City Road, blocking Eugene. The remaining four, Heintzelman's two and one each from Sumner and Porter, were in front of Glendale, ready for whatever came their way. The result was a savage stand-up fight, beginning 2 hours before sundown and continuing through twilight into darkness. Longstreet went in, driving hard and capturing guns in the rush, but presently, encountering stiffer resistance as the blue mass absorbed the blow, called for help. Hill's men charged with a yell on the left and right, their backs to the setting sun. Again the Federals yielded, again they rallied. The fighting now was hand to hand, bayonets crossed and musket butts cracked skulls. More guns were taken, lost and retaken, as the lines surged back and forth in the dusk, across clearings and through woods. Longstreet remained calm, feeding men into the holocaust and matching his skill against the odds. When a group of jubilant Virginians brought him a captured brigadier, he recognized an old army comrade, George McCall, commander of Porter's 3rd Division. About to extend his hand in greeting, he saw that the prisoner was in no mood for the amenities, however, and directed instead that he be taken at once to Richmond as a trophy. Gradually, the battle racket died away in the darkness. The Confederates held the field. Having paid for it with the blood of 3,300 men, they received by way of dividend 18 Yankee guns and one Yankee general. But these were the only substantial results. The real objective, McClellan's supply train and reserve artillery, for which he would have had to turn and fight without the alternative of an orderly retreat, was not obtained, and in fact had been unobtainable since midday, 5 hours before the battle started. Under cover of night, the Federals continued their withdrawal toward the James. McClellan himself was there already, having gone aboard the ironclad Galena to confer with the gunboat commander and arrange for support while Keyes and Porter were filing into position on Malvern Hill. A telegram from Lincoln, sent 2 days ago and rerouted through Fortress Monroe, showed something of the official reaction up to the time the White House line was cut. "Save your army at all events," the president urged him. "We'll send reinforcements as fast as we can. If you have had a drawn battle or a repulse, it is the price we pay for the enemy not being in Washington. It is the nature of the case, and neither you nor the government are to blame. Though he agreed with no more than half of the final sentence, McClellan was too worn down by exertion and anxiety to press the point just yet. At sundown, proud but gloomy, he replied, "My army has behaved superbly, and have done all that men can do. If none of us escape, we shall at least have done honor to the country. I shall do my best to save the army. Send more gunboats." Tuesday's dawn, July 1st, showed the Union lines abandoned around Glendale, and though there was no longer a chance for interception, Lee ordered his army to concentrate for pursuit. He had no real way of knowing what effect the past 6 days of fighting and the past 5 days of falling back might have had on the Federals. Up to now, they had fought stubbornly and hard, but last night's fierce encounter, followed by still another retreat, might have tipped the scale toward panic. If they were, in fact, demoralized, the slightest tap on this seventh day of combat might cause the Blue Host to fly apart like an overstrained machine and thus expose it to destruction in detail. At any rate, Lee was determined to take advantage of any opening McClellan might afford him for striking a crippling blow. Magruder was already on hand, having countermarched in the night to relieve the battle-weary men of Hill and Longstreet. The Southern commander joined these three while awaiting the arrival of Jackson and Huger, whose advance was unopposed. He bore himself calmly, but it was obviously with considerable effort. The cumulative strain of watching his combinations fail and his plans go awry because of fumbling had upset his digestion and shortened his temper. Longstreet, on the other hand, seemed as confident as ever, if not more so. When a Union surgeon came to request protection and supplies for the wounded he had stayed behind to tend, Longstreet asked him what division he belonged to. "McCall's," the doctor said. "Well, McCall is safe in Richmond," Longstreet told him, adding that if it had not been for the Pennsylvanians' stubborn resistance along this road the day before, "we would have captured your whole army." "Never mind," he said, "we will do it yet." Lee said nothing. But Harvey Hill, whom they presently encountered, did not agree with the burly eupeptic Georgian. One of Hill's chaplains, a native of the region, had given him a description of the terrain ahead. It was well adapted for defense, he said, particularly Malvern Hill, which the Bluecoats were reported to have occupied already. "If General McClellan is there in strength, we had better let him alone," the saturnine Hill declared. "Don't get scared now that we have got him whipped," Longstreet broke in with a laugh. Hill made no reply to this, nor did Lee, who apparently had all he could do to maintain his composure. In this he was not entirely successful, however, when a newly arrived brigadier came up to the group and expressed concern lest McClellan escape. The gray-bearded commander's patience snapped. "Yes, he will get away," Lee said bitterly, "because I cannot have my orders carried out." Events, coming hard on the heels of this uncharacteristic outburst, did not improve the general's disposition. Malvern Hill was less than 3 miles away, no more than a normal one-hour march, but with seven divisions crowding a single southward road, the result was confusion and delay. A parallel road half a mile to the east, which Keyes had taken with his whole corps the previous night, went unused because it was not shown on Lee's crude map. On top of all this, a mix-up in Magruder's orders sent his division swinging off on a tangent. Time was lost before he was missed, and still more before he could be found and put back on the track. It soon developed that today, as on every other of what was to be known as the 7 days, one gigantic 20-mile-long conflict, with bewildering intermissions, not for resting, but for groping spastically in the general direction of an enemy who fought so savagely when cornered that the whole thing had been rather like playing blind man's buff with a buzzsaw. Lee's army would not be within striking distance of the day's objective until well past noon. In fact, it was 1:30 before 6 of the 8 Confederate divisions, Magruder was still off on his tangent, and Holmes was still licking yesterday's wounds down on the river road, had filed into position facing the 150-foot height, which bristled with guns parked hub to hub to the front and rear of long, blue, stalwart-looking lines of federal infantry. Bad as it looked at first glance from the attacker's point of view, closer inspection of the position McClellan had chosen produced even stronger confirmation of D.H. Hill's long-range opinion that we had better let him alone. Porter, who was in tactical command, was obviously ready for anything Lee might throw at him there on the undulating plateau, a mile and a half long and half as wide. He and Keyes, with two divisions each, held a line about midway up the slope. Heintzelman was in immediate reserve with two more, while Sumner and Franklin remained on call in case their four were needed, which seemed unlikely considering the narrow front, the apparently unassailable flanks, and the direct support of more than 100 guns. These last were what made the position especially forbidding, and it was on them that Porter seemingly placed his chief reliance. First, in advance of the heavy ranks of infantry on the left and center, field pieces were massed in a long crescent so as to sweep the open ground across which the graybacks would have to charge if they were to come within musket range of the defenders. Other batteries were in support all the way back to the brow of the hill, where siege guns were emplaced. Still farther back on the James itself, naval gunners stood to their pieces, ready to arch their heavy-caliber shells into the ranks of the attackers. In full view of all those cannon frowning down, attack seemed outright suicide. But this was Lee's last chance to destroy McClellan before he reached the safety of the river, rested and refitted his army under cover of the gunboats, then launched another drive on Richmond, giving the Confederates the bloody task of driving him back again. This first repulse had been hard enough to manage. A second, with the Federal host enlarged by reinforcements and based securely on the James, might be impossible. With this in mind, and also the thought that the stalwart look of the Union troops, near the end of their long retreat, might be no more than a veneer that covered profound despair, Lee ordered his men to take up assault positions while he searched for a way to get at those people and administer the rap which he hoped would cause them to come apart at the seams. UG was on the right, D.H. Hill in the center. Magruder would form between them when he arrived. Jackson and Ewell were on the left. Longstreet and A.P. Hill, still weary from yesterday's fight, were in reserve. Holmes, around on the river road, would cooperate as developments permitted. This arrangement left much to be desired, but it would have to do until a better could be evolved. What that would be, Lee did not know until he was on his way to reconnoiter Jackson's front, which seemed to offer the best chance for success. As he set out, a message came from Longstreet, who reported that he had found a good artillery position on the right, a terraced knoll with a direct line of fire to the Union batteries. From there, he added, he could see on the Confederate left an open field which also afforded an excellent position. If guns were massed at these two points, Longstreet said, 40 on the right, say, and twice that many on the left, the converging fire would throw the northern batteries into confusion and open the way for an attack by the southern infantry. Lee saw in this the opportunity he was seeking. A charge in the style of the one across Bozen's Swamp 4 days ago, with even greater rewards to follow success. Accordingly, he ordered the guns to occupy the two positions and notified his frontline commanders of the plan. One of UG's brigades, posted closest to the enemy, would be able to judge best the effect of the bombardment. If it was successful, the brigade would go forward with a yell, which in turn would be the signal for an end-to-end assault by the whole gray line, the object being to close with the Blue Army and destroy it there on the rolling slopes of Malvern Hill. It was not going to be easy, it might even be impossible. But as a last chance, Lee thought it worth a try. In any case, if the bombardment failed in its purpose, the infantry need not advance. Already they were taking punishment from the siege guns on the brow of the hill as they filed through the wooded and swampy lowlands to get in position for the jump-off. The heavy-caliber fire was deliberate and deadly, as Harvey Hill could testify. While his troops were forming under a rain of metal and splintered branches, the North Carolinian sat at a camp table on the exposed side of a large tree, drafting orders for the attack, when one of his officers urged him at least to put the trunk between him and the roaring guns. "Don't worry about me," Hill said. "Look after the men. I'm not going to be killed until my time comes." With that, a shell crashed into the earth alongside him, the concussion lifting the predestinarian from his chair and rolling him over and over on the ground. Hill got up, shook the dirt from his coat, the breast of which had been torn by a splinter of iron, and resumed his seat on the far side of the tree. This and what followed were perhaps the basis for his later statement that with Confederate infantry and Yankee artillery, he believed he could whip any army in the world. What followed was a frustrating demonstration that Southern gunners were no match for their Northern counterparts, not here and now, at any rate. On the right and left, batteries came up piecemeal, no more than 20 guns in all, less than a fifth the number Longstreet had recommended, and piecemeal they were bludgeoned by counter-battery fire. Nowhere in this war would Federal artillerists have a greater advantage, and they did not neglect it. Sometimes concentrating as many as 50 guns on a single rebel battery, they pounded it to pulp and wreckage before changing deflection to repeat the treatment on the next one down the line. Half an hour was all they needed. By 2:30, with the whole Union position still billowing smoke and coughing flame, one 6-gun battery near the center, for example, fired 1,300 rounds in the course of the afternoon. Not a single Confederate piece with a direct line of fire remained in action. What had been intended as a preliminary bombardment paving the way for the infantry had been reduced to a bloody farce. If Lee's soldiers were to come to grips with the bluecoats on that gun-jarred slope, they would have to do it some other way than this. The Southern commander resumed his reconnaissance on the left, hoping to find an opening for an attack that would flank the Federals off the hill. Far on the right, Huger's lead brigade was working its way forward. In its front was a large field of wheat, lately gleaned, with sharpshooters lurking behind the gathered sheaves of grain. Little would be gained by taking the wheat field. On its far side, just beyond musket range, the crescent of guns standing hub to hub could clip the stubble as close as the scythe had lately done. But Huger's men, bitterly conscious that theirs was the only division which had done no real fighting since the opening attack 6 days ago, were determined to have a share in the bloody work of driving the invaders. Taking their losses, they surged ahead and finally took cover in a gully at the near edge of the wheat field, well in advance of the rest of the army, while the sharpshooters fell back on their guns. Magruder, arriving about 4 o'clock to assume command of the right, notified Lee that he was on hand at last and that Huger's men had driven the enemy and made a substantial lodgment. Lee, meanwhile, had found what he thought might be an opening on the left and had sent word for the men of Longstreet and A.P. Hill to come forward and exploit it. Weary though they were all he had. Just then, however, as Lee rode back toward the center, the message arrived from Magruder, together with one from the left, reporting signs of a Federal withdrawal. That changed everything. This first advantage, if followed up, might throw McClellan's army into panic and open the way for an all-out flank-to-flank assault. Quickly he gave verbal orders, which the messenger took down for delivery to Magruder. "General Lee expects you to advance rapidly. He says it is reported the enemy is getting off. Press forward your whole command." By now, Prince John had had a chance to look into the situation a bit more carefully on the right, and as a result he was feeling considerably less sanguine. However, Lee's 3-hour-old order calling for a general advance if the preliminary bombardment was successful reached him soon after he arrived. Since it bore no time of dispatch, Magruder assumed that it was current, an assumption presently strengthened by the prompt arrival of the message directing him to press forward your whole command. That was what he did, and he did it without delay, despite the unpromising aspect which a hasty examination had revealed on this shell-torn quarter of the field. Quickly he formed his men and sent them forward on the right of Eugene's lead brigade, which cheered at the sight of this unexpected support, leaped eagerly out of the gully, and joined the charge across the wheat field. On the far side of the cropped plain, the long crescent of guns began to buck and jump with redoubled fury, licking the stubble with tongues of flame. After the failure of the preliminary bombardment and the encounter with the shell that had seemed to have his name written on it, D.H. Hill had decided that no large-scale attack would be delivered. All the same, since Lee had never countermanded the tentative order for an advance if Eugene's troops raised a yell, he kept his brigade commanders with him, ready to give them time-saving verbal instructions in case the unexpected signal came. Near sundown, just as he was advising them to return to their men and prepare to bed them down for the night, the firing rose suddenly to crescendo on the smoky hill, and the sound of cheering broke out on the right. "That must be the general advance," Hill exclaimed. "Bring up your brigades as soon as possible and join it." Quickly they rejoined their commands and led them forward through the woods. By the time they came out into the open, however, a fair proportion of the troops who had attacked on the right were lying dead or dying in the wheat field. The rest were either hugging what little defilade they could find or else were running pell-mell toward the rear. The flaming crescent of Union guns shifted east in time to catch the new arrivers at the start of their advance up the long slope. "It was not war, it was murder," Hill said later. That was what it was, all right. Mass murder. Hill and Magruder and Eugene gave it all they had, despite the hurricane of shells, only to see charge after charge break in blood and flow back from the defiant line of guns. Dusk put an end to the fighting. None of it had been hand-to-hand, and much of it had been done beyond musket range, though the cannon sustained the one-sided argument past dark. By that time, 5,590 Confederates had fallen, as compared with less than a third that many Federals. And all for nothing. The 7 days were over. Lee had failed in his final effort to keep McClellan from reaching the James. Now that he had examined the ground over which the useless attack had been launched, he saw that it had clearly been foredoomed. And he could not understand how any commander, there on the scene, with all those guns staring down his throat, could not have known better than to undertake it in the first place. So he went looking for Magruder. At Savage Station, 2 days ago, he had reproached him by messenger. This time he intended to do it in person, or at any rate demand an explanation. At last he found him. "General Magruder, why did you attack?" he said. Prince John had remained silent under the previous rebuke, but this time he had an answer, and he gave it. "In obedience to your orders, twice repeated," he told Lee. Jackson's men at the far end of the line of battle had spent another non-fighting day, their sixth out of the seven. Only the artillery had been engaged on the left. The infantry, moving forward through the swampy underbrush, had not been able to come up in time to take part in the assault, though as Stonewall rode through the gathering dusk, he found one of Ewell's brigadiers forming his troops under cover of the woods, their faces reflecting the eerie red flicker of muzzle flashes out on the slope ahead. Jackson drew rein. "What are you going to do?" he asked. "I am going to charge those batteries, sir." "I guess you had better not try it," Stonewall told him. "General D.H. Hill has just tried it with his whole division and been repulsed. I guess you had better not try it, sir." Presently the firing died to a rumble. About 10 o'clock it stopped, and out of the moonless darkness came the agonized cries of the wounded, beyond reach on the up-tilted, blood-soaked plain. Jackson lay down on a blanket and went to sleep. 3 hours later he was wakened by Ewell and Harvey Hill, who believed that McClellan was preparing to launch a dawn attack, and had come to ask if Stonewall wanted them to make any special dispositions to meet it. One sleepy officer, seeing the three men squatting in a circle, thought they resembled a triumvirate of frogs. "No," Jackson said quietly, I believe he will clear out in the morning." He was right. McClellan did clear out, but not without having to override the protests of several high-ranking subordinates. Even Porter, who was his friend and generally favored all his actions, opposed this one, saying that he believed a determined advance from Malvern Hill would throw Lee into retreat through the streets of his capital. Phil Kearney, the hardest fighter among the brigade commanders, a spike-bearded New Jersey professional whose thirst for combat had not been slaked by the loss of an arm while leading a cavalry charge in Mexico, was the most vociferous of all. When the retirement order reached him at the close of the battle, he rose in the presence of his staff and cried out in anger, "I, Philip Kearney, an old soldier, enter my solemn protest against this order for retreat. We ought, instead of retreating, to follow up the enemy and take Richmond. And in full view of the responsibility of such a declaration, I say to you all, such an order can only be prompted by cowardice or treason." McClellan either ignored this protest or else he never heard it. In any case, his reply to Kearney would have been the same as the one he had made 3 days ago, when a cavalry colonel suggested a dash on the southern capital, while Lee still had most of his men on the north bank of the Chickahominy. "If an army can save this country, it will be the Army of the Potomac, and it must be saved for that purpose." He was taking no chances. If Lee would let him alone for the present, he was more than willing to return the favor. And so it was that the same cavalry colonel found himself and his regiment alone on the hilltop next morning at dawn, with only a skirmish line of infantry left for show, while the rest of the army followed the road to Harrison's Landing. A mizzling rain had fallen before daylight, and mist blotted the lower slope from view. He could see nothing down there, but out of the mist came a babble of cries and wails and groans from the wounded who had managed to live through the night. After a while, the sun came out, and when it burned the mist away, he saw a thing he would never forget, and never remember except with a shudder. Down there on the lower slope, the bodies of 5,000 gray-clad soldiers were woven into a carpet of cold or agonized flesh. "A third of them were dead or dying," he later wrote, "but enough of them were alive and moving to give the field a singular crawling effect." Disposing his troops in a pretense of strength, the colonel presently agreed with feigned reluctance to an informal truce. And while rebel ambulance details came out of the woods and moved among the sufferers on the hillside, he withdrew under cover of a drenching rain and joined the rear of the retreating column, the van of which was led by the army commander. "My men are completely exhausted," McClellan wired Washington, "and I dread the result if we are attacked today by fresh troops. I now pray for time. My men have proved themselves the equals of any troops in the world, but they are worn out. We have failed to win only because overpowered by superior numbers." He had not lost, he had failed to win. Nor had he been outfought, he had been overpowered. So he said, and if his words were unrealistic, it might be added an extenuation, that all the events of the past week had occurred in an atmosphere of unreality. Watching the week-long, 20-mile-wide conflict had been something like watching a small man beat a large one, not by nimble footwork or artful dodging or even boxing skill, but rather by brute force, driving headlong, never relinquishing the offensive, and taking a good deal more punishment than he inflicted. This last was confirmed by the casualty lists, which were beginning to be compiled now that the two armies were out of contact. 3 months ago, the news of Shiloh had arrived from the west with a dreadful shock. 23,741 American fighting men had been killed, wounded, or captured in that battle. Now the east's turn had come. The best and the worst that could be said of the battle known as the 7 days was that this grim western figure had been exceeded by more than half. 36,463 was the total. And though in the earlier conflict most of the casualties had been Union, here it was the other way around. 15,849 Federals and 20,614 Confederates were on the list. In killed and wounded, moreover, the advantage increased from almost 3-4 to better than 1-2. Nearly 10,000 Federals had fallen, 1,734 killed and 8,062 wounded, as opposed to nearly 20,000 Confederates, 3,478 and 16,261. However, this preponderance was considerably reduced by the 6,053 Federals missing in action. Only 875 Confederates were in that category. In the end, since approximately half of the uncaptured wounded would return in time to the ranks of their respective armies, this made the actual loss of fighting men somewhat lower for the Confederates, 8,000 of whom would be returning, whereas half of the Federal wounded had been captured, leaving only half of the remainder to return, about 2,000, so that the actual loss in combat strength after recuperation of the injured would be 14,000 Federals and 12,500 Confederates. Knowing as he did that the South could not afford a swapping game on anything like a man-for-man basis of exchange, Lee found little solace in such figures. When Jackson and Longstreet came by headquarters seeking refuge from the storm while the aid men and the burial squads worked among the wounded and the dead on the rain-swept hillside, he asked Longstreet for his impression of the fighting. "I think you hurt them about as much as they hurt you," the forthright Georgian told him. Lee winced at this, for he knew how badly his army had suffered, and there was a touch of irony in his reply. "Then I am glad we punished them well, at any rate." Longstreet left. Soon afterward, unexpectedly, President Davis walked in, taking Lee so much by surprise that he omitted the "Mr." from his salutation. "President," he said, "I am delighted to see you." They shook hands. Across the room, Jackson had risen and was standing at attention beside his chair. Lee saw Davis looking at him. "Why, President, don't you know General Jackson? This is our Stonewall Jackson." They were acquainted, of course, but the relationship had been strained by the Romney controversy, in which the Mississippian had supported Benjamin and the Virginian had submitted his resignation. The result in this first meeting since then was a curious exchange. Observing the Valley General's bristling manner, Davis did not offer his hand. Instead, he bowed, and Jackson replied with a rigid salute. Neither of them said anything to the other. Their last encounter had been under similar circumstances after the victory at Manassas, and here again the question was how or whether to pursue a driven foe. Stonewall felt the same way about it as he had felt a year ago, but Lee and Davis agreed that the disorganized condition of the Southern Army precluded any chance to overcome the Federals' substantial head start down the muddy road, which would be under gunboat fire at several points. Asked for his opinion, Jackson said dourly, "They have not all got away if we go immediately after them." Lee shook his head. For the present, at least, pursuit would have to be left to the cavalry, which had arrived the night before. The rest of the army would spend what was left of the day attending the wounded, burying the dead, and preparing to resume the chase tomorrow. For today, then, as well as for a good part of tomorrow, since Harrison's Landing was 8 muddy miles from Malvern Hill, Jeb Stuart had McClellan to himself. And the truth was, he preferred it so. Except for an encounter with a gunboat on the Pamunkey 3 days ago, he reported with pride that he had repulsed it with a single howitzer, forcing the monster to close its ports and slink off, full speed astern. "What do you think of that?" he wrote his wife. Outpost duty along the lower Chickahominy had kept his troopers out of the main channel of events during the past momentous week, affording them little chance for a share in the glory of driving the Yankees away from the gates of Richmond. All that was behind them at last, however, and now that they were back in the limelight, stage center, so to speak, their plumed commander intended to make the most of whatever opportunities came his way. Today there were few, the pursuit being mainly a matter of gathering up the stragglers and equipment which the Blue Host dribbled in its wake on the river road. Night fell before he found what he was seeking. Next morning, though, July 3rd, the rain had slacked and stopped in the night, the day was bright and sunny, he came within sight of the answer to his prayers. The Northern Army had gone into camp beside the James, and Stuart, mounting a low ridge called Evelington Heights, looked down and saw the quarry spread out before him, close-packed and apparently ripe for destruction. McClellan had chosen the position with care. The creeks on his flanks, one of which curved along his front as well, and the gunboats anchored in his rear, their big guns trained across the meadows, gave him excellent protection from attack by infantry. But in failing to occupy Evelington Heights, he had left his soldiers open to terrible punishment from the plunging fire of any guns the Confederates might bring up. Stuart saw this at once and quickly got off a message informing Lee of the opportunity. Unwilling to wait, however, and with no regard for the long odds or concern for the consequences of alerting the Federals to the danger of leaving the dominant ridge unoccupied, he brought up the little howitzer that had peppered a gunboat into retreat 4 days ago, and at 9 o'clock opened fire on the bluecoats huddled on the mudflats down below. The effect was instantaneous and spectacular, a moil of startled men and rearing horses thrown abruptly into milling consternation. Stuart was delighted. Informed by Lee that Longstreet, Jackson, and A.P. Hill were on the march to join him, he kept the little field piece barking terrier-like to sustain the confusion until they arrived to compound it. But it was a case of too little too soon. Spotting the trouble at last, the Federals moved to get rid of it by advancing a 6-gun battery and a regiment of infantry. Stuart held his position until he was down to his last 2 rounds, still hoping for the arrival of support. At 2 o'clock, with hostile guns approaching his front and infantry probing around his flanks, he fired his last 2 shells and pulled back off the ridge. He had done no appreciable damage, but he was pleased that he had found this chance to give McClellan one last prod. Moreover, he wrote home next day, "If the army had been up with me, we would have finished his business." As it was, however, the lead elements of Longstreet's division, moving in front of the other two, did not arrive until sunset. Too late to undertake an attack, even if the Heights had still been naked of guns, which they were not. McClellan had been shown his mistake and had moved to rectify it. Next morning, the ridge was crowned with batteries, supported by heavy columns of infantry. Hill and Jackson had come up by then, and Longstreet, who assumed command by seniority, put them in line for an all-out assault, holding his own division in reserve. Lee arrived to find Jackson protesting that his men were too weary and the Heights too strong for the attack to be anything but a fiasco. After looking the situation over, Lee was obliged to agree regretfully with Stonewall. The assault was canceled and the troops went into camp. The campaign was over. Certain regiments were left on picket duty to observe the enemy, and one among them was stationed in a clump of woods overlooking an open field, beyond which there was another clump of woods where a Federal regiment was posted. All in all, the situation indicated a sudden renewal of bloodshed. This was the 4th of July, however, and what was more, the field was full of ripe blackberries. So, as one rebel private later remembered, "Our boys and the Yanks made a bargain not to fire at each other, and went out in the field, leaving one man on each post with the arms, and gathered berries together and talked over the fight, traded tobacco and coffee, and exchanged newspapers as peacefully and kindly as if they had not been engaged for the last 7 days in butchering one another." Part 3. Chapter 6. The Sun Shines South. Napoleon was taking the waters at Vichy when news of the 7 days reached him in mid-July. Hard on its heels came John Slidell with an offer of 100,000 bales of cotton if France would denounce the Federal blockade. Unable to act alone in the matter, however eager he might be to feed his country's looms, the Emperor, called Napoleon the Little to distinguish him from his illustrious uncle, promptly telegraphed his foreign minister, "Demandez au gouvernement anglais s'il ne croit pas le moment venu de reconnaître le Sud." Across the Channel, the mills were hungry too, and though Mason was somewhat handicapped by the impracticality of offering an Englishman anything so indelicate as a bribe, the time was propitious from the Confederate point of view. There is an all but unanimous belief that you cannot subject the South to the Union, an influential partisan of Northern interests was informing a friend across the ocean. I feel quite convinced that unless cotton comes in considerable quantities before the end of the year, the governments of Europe will be knocking at your door. Moreover, even as he wrote, a pro-Confederate member was introducing a motion before Parliament for British-French mediation in the American Civil War, which in effect amounted to recognition of the infant nation as a reward for throwing the blue invader off its doorstep. Fortunately, however, from the federal point of view, the long vacation was underway, and before the issue could be forced, the cabinet was scattered from Scotland to Germany in pursuit of grouse and relaxation. Action was deferred. Distracting as these transatlantic dangers were, or might have been, the truth was Lincoln had more than enough material for full-time worry here at home. Hedged in by cares, blamed alike by critics right and left of the hostile center, he later said of the period under question, "I was as nearly inconsolable as I could be and live." In contrast to the adulation heaped on Davis, whose critics had been muzzled by the apparent vindication of his policies, and whose countrymen now hailed him as a second Hezekiah, the Northern leader heard himself likened unto Sennacherib,